Welcome to minute 128 of season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we fubar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Matthew Simpson, a freelance film and television critic. Welcome back to the show, Matthew.
One more time, thank you for having me. This has been very fun, very interesting conversation so far, and I look forward to continuing it.
Just you wait. We're not even close to being done. All right, so minute 128 begins with Miller looking up and signaling to Jackson, and ends with Mellish and Henderson getting ready to lock and load. So yesterday we ended things with Miller and all of his men starting to realize that they're getting very close to having, I guess, a surprise visit, you know, from these German tanks that or the German army soldiers, the German troops that they've been waiting for. Things are getting a little closer, and we've been waiting for this also. I mean, these characters for the last probably close to two weeks of this show have been just trying to figure out what did they want to do with their spare time. It's an interesting way to tell this type of story where you have a lot of downtime. I mean, do you think that do you think that they overdo it here or not? What do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's one of the sort of classic aspects of the war story and going to war in particular is, you know, that like furious moments of action that punctuate long periods of malaise is a pretty common way a war goes for a soldier. So I think that this, again, I think I said last episode or episode before that like this whole sequence leading up to the battle is one of my favorite in the whole, pretty much my favorite in the whole movie, where they are just existing in their downtime, trying to pass the time, trying to find moments of humanity before, you know, what happens. They all know it's coming. They're all trying to find some semblance of normalcy before it does happen. And I think it's one of the best acted sequences of the whole film. And one of the most important, too. I think that this part that we're talking about, the slow build towards the tanks arriving, is all incredible work from everyone involved. And very true to life. Probably very. I haven't been to war, so I couldn't say 100%, but I think probably very true to life. It's a very common element in war stories.
Okay. Do you think it has a lot to do with the fact that, you know, they're using this amount of time to develop these characters for us so that we're going to get a little more teary-eyed when they don't make it out?
I think that's probably certainly part of it. You know, I think that probably in real life, there's definitely lots of downtime when you're in the army, when you're deployed. And I think that using that time judiciously to make us care more about the characters, to give us more insight to the character, is probably the most Hollywood way to approach that time. I'm sure that we talked yesterday a little bit about how we don't really know how much time passes between them getting to Rommel and the Germans arriving at Rommel, and it's potentially like days. So I'm sure there's lots of other time that these characters would just be like left with their own devices or sleeping or panicking, you know, whatever they're going to go through. So we just get the highlight reel. So I think that's pretty acceptable and a very good way to handle it in a movie.
Right. But if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, when thinking about the fact that Miller and his men have decided that they're going to stay, you know, is their plan to stay indefinitely? Like, do they, you know, if they have no idea when this battle is going to be taking place, you know, this battle can take place today, tomorrow, 2 weeks from now. You know, there's nobody, they don't know when the German army is going to be trying to get across, you know, this river on this bridge. So to me, it's a little strange that, you know, they've made this decision that they're going to stick around. You know, if they were to say, okay, we'll stick around for 2 days or whatever it is to try and help out. But, you know, we do have this mission. But here it's a completely open invitation, I guess you can say.
So, yeah, I don't see. I think it's probably, you know, from what I know about how the invasion of Normandy went, which is not nothing. I think that that's probably fairly accurate. You know, I think that they don't outright say it, but my guess would be that Miller and company would stay until either the mission is done or they're relieved, because the bridge is important and Ryan's not going to leave it unmanned. So, and they can't just like drag him kicking and screaming away. So they have to make the choice, and they make the choice to stay. And I think that choice is until they can leave. And that means either, you know, defeating the advance or being relieved. And I think it feels pretty accurate to me. It feels pretty understandable. It also, you know, gives Miller something to, you know, World War II is one of those ones where there's such an unequivocal bad guy. And I feel like Miller wants something to fight for in this moment. And he gets it, you know. It's I'm sort of rambling at the moment.
So no, I don't think you're rambling at all. I think it's great. That's what I was, you know, looking to hear. I was wanting to hear your opinion on that. So yeah, for sure. There's no question about that one. No, because I look at it from the perspective that you know, Miller has this mission, and you know, his quote that we talked about a few weeks ago of him basically saying, well, you know, I just want to finish this mission so I can get to the next mission and get to the next mission and after that finally get home. So it's a little strange for him to at this point say, well, you know what, I'm not going to do this mission. I'm not going to end this mission in order to continue. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I guess the difference, or not difference, but the way I'm looking at it is that is true. He needs to get to the next mission to get home to his wife. But that also needs to be true for his men. And it also needs to be true for Ryan. And leaving Rommel early would not give that to Ryan in particular, but to the rest of the men too. You know, like they wouldn't have, as the, you know, the last line of that Miller has, like they would not have earned the right to go home if they didn't finish this part of the mission, right? They did not accept this challenge. So I think it does. I think what you're saying makes is true. Like it's definitely a delay in his plan and his personal mission to get home. But he does have to, as he says earlier, he does have to like earn the right to go home, right? And I think that he thinks that, and Ryan explicitly says basically that if they don't stay and finish this, then they won't have earned it. And I think that's quite, so I think it's quite relatable, quite relatable and true and human. Mm-hmm. I like it.
Okay. All right. That's fair. So at this point, Miller then looks up and, you know, because they're hearing the sounds of the tanks, I guess, getting closer to them. And then he, you know, he looks up into to the bell tower where we have Jackson up there with Parker. And he basically signals him by whistling, or at least what it looks like that he's doing, because he puts his fingers next to his mouth. I didn't quite hear him whistling, but it looks like he's whistling. And then, you know, he starts translating the explanation from Jackson, you know, what Jackson sees from up on top of this, you know, bell tower. And Miller then relays to everyone else, based on, you know, the signals that Jackson gave him. He goes, enemy from the east. He sees Tiger tanks, two of them, Panzer tanks, two of them, infantry, 50 plus change. And then you see that he sort of has this sadness come over his face. That, like, he didn't expect there to be that many. he's a little...
Yeah, it's worse than expected,
he's
for sure.
He's a little shocked. I thought there'd be less, but having basically four tanks and more than 50 infantrymen come up, and we never know exactly how many people are there defending Rommel. They never give us an actual number. So what I will be doing over the next few weeks is we will be counting. And there's unfortunately only one way to count these men. It's, basically the ones that aren't going to be making it. But I plan to be making a count to try to figure out how many men are there to defend Rommel.
Yeah, it's not that many for sure. Because when they arrive at Rommel, they're five of them, six right. of them now. Miller, Sarge, Mellish. Yeah, right. So there's six of them.
There's six of them.
And then
there were eight.
There's Ryan. Then there's Ryan and Max Martini, and then there's the three guys looking on when Ryan's told that his brothers had passed. There's the demolitions guy. So yeah, there's maybe a dozen of them. Like
there are a lot more that are going to die.
Yeah. So, I'm sure there's other like red shirts in the mix, but I'm just thinking of at least guys who spoke. Yes,
there are lots of red shirts here.
Yeah.
But you see, you got your Star Trek reference in.
Yeah. It was bound to happen.
But you like being a command red shirt, so that's fine. But you see, in later shows, they still, fans still refer to them as red shirts, even though they don't wear red. Correct?
They do, yeah. Yeah, because operations and security swapped colors in the 24th century. So, but red shirts is still, they didn't have as much of that in the 24th century as they did in the original, though, where they'd beam down with random security guy number four and he would die. yeah.
Yeah, it's nice seeing how they do you know why they changed that? I know it's not Saving Private Ryan, but maybe I always wondered why they decided to change the colors.
Off the top of my head, I'm sure that I at one point knew the answer to this. But at the current moment, I do not.
So, sorry I brought it up. Got it. So he mentions two types of tanks, Tiger tanks and Panzer tanks. Do you know anything about either of those tanks?
I used to. I couldn't tell you too many of the differences now. I do know that I think it's the Tiger tanks aren't technically supposed to be there. One of them is not appropriate for the theater, but I couldn't remember which one it is. But no, beyond that, I don't really remember.
Okay, so the Tiger tanks, they had a few that were a few models, but the first model was the Tiger One, which they started designing and making it in 1938, and it was used during 42 to 45. And it was used in northern France in 1944. So you don't have to worry about this isn't the one that's not meant to be in this in this area. It actually is supposed to be there. It also was used in Africa and in Russia. Basically gave it was the German army's first armored fighting vehicle that had an 8.8 centimeter gun that was used on it. They built 1,347 of them between August 42 and August 44. And then they phased them out because they started creating the Tiger II, which we will get to and explain afterwards. The slight differences about that. It was definitely a ahead of its time, the way it was designed and everything like that. The biggest criticism that people had for it was that it was over-engineered, and that it cost a lot because they used expensive material and stuff like that. But it was something that it's a tank that was very prone to track failures and breakdowns, and it cost a lot of money to actually maintain it. And the reason they gave the nickname Tiger was given by the they had a Ministry of Armament and Ammunition. So on August 7th, 1941, they gave it they gave it that name, the Tiger, in order to, I guess, make it seem ferocious and stuff like that. It was only it only became known as the Tiger One once they started making the Tiger Two, from that perspective. How many Tiger One tanks do you think are still have survived and are in museums or somewhere around the world? What do you think? Yeah,
Like to
today.
this day, I don't know, a dozen.
There are nine. So yeah, pretty close.
Oh, yeah.
Pretty close. Most of them don't run. There's one in England that there's a tank museum, and it's the only example that they were able to restore to work in running order. Most of the time they're just I guess tanks that kids can climb on and have fun on, I guess you can say. So then you have the Tiger II, which was used during 1944-45. They designed that in 1943, and the whole idea obviously was to make the Tiger tank more effective than it was before. They built only 492 of them, and the official name of it was a Panzerkampfwagen Tiger Ost-B. And they just called it Tiger II or Tiger B. And it was also informally known as the Konigstiger, which was it's the German name for a Bengal tiger, literally a king tiger. Which was also how it was known by Allied forces. They called it either the King Tiger or the Royal Tiger. And what they basically did was is that the Tiger II was a mixture of stuff they had in the Tiger I and something that they used in the Panzer, which we will get to shortly also. It was the Tiger II was issued to heavy tank battalions of the army and the Waffen-SS, and it was first used in combat on July 11, 1944, during the Battle of Normandy, or the fight for Normandy. So basically what we're going to see here can't be Tiger IIs. They're only going to be Tiger Ones, because this we're still a month away from them showing up and stuff like that. And so surviving vehicles, there's even less. There is one in France that is in working condition and is able to be used. And it's actually something that's accessible to the public. Someone shows up at the tank museum there, you can go I guess play on it. It was the one they have there was actually abandoned by its crew on August 23rd, 1944, because it had engine problems in France, and the French army salvaged it, and then they kept it in a factory before for 30 years before it was transferred to the museum in 1975. They don't know the actual number. They think it was 123, but some people believe that maybe it was production number 233. I don't know. And but that was because a French colonel who had his tank destroyed at the end of the war was it was destroyed by a Tiger II with the number 233, so he decided to rename this one, make it that it's this one. I don't know.
That's, I mean, that sounds
Yeah.
very plausible.
And then after that we have the Panzers, which again it's there were two Panzers. A Panzer was a light tank that was used from 1934 to 1945. So again it was this was pre-World War II. It was used in the Spanish Civil War and the World War II, and they made 1,659 of them, and then they had three different types of how they made them. They were slightly different over the years and stuff like that. It was short for Panzerkampfwagen One, which meant Armored Fighting Vehicle Mark One. The official designation was SDKFZ 101, which means Special Purpose Vehicle 101. They started designing in 1932 and started producing in 1934, and it was meant only as a training tank in order to get the German army to start knowing how to work with armored vehicles and things like that. Like I said, it saw combat in during the Spanish Civil War. And then, you know, when they invaded Poland and France and Russia and North Africa, so they basically claimed that everything that they did in the Spanish Civil War helped them with the invasion of Poland in 1939 and France in 1940 by learning so much about the Panzers and how they you know how they work and stuff like that.
Yeah, it all makes sense.
The problem is that it had thin armor and light armaments of only two machine guns, which made it that it was much more difficult for Panzers to survive. So I found a list of 13 surviving Panzer ones around the world that are in different museums. There's one in Norway, one in Sweden, one in Germany, one in Spain, one in the US, another one in France. You have another one in Spain, Jordan, Russia. There's two in Russia, another one in the US at the United States Army Ordnance Training and Heritage Center in Fort Gregg Adams in the US. And then you have Australia. And then there's one in Belgium that is just the hull. They couldn't there wasn't more that survived, I guess you can say. And then you have the Panzer II, which obviously was the next generation of tanks. They actually started designing them in 1934. And they started using them in 36 already. So it was used from 36 to 45. They made 1,856 of them. Obviously the Panzer II was a little bit better than the first one. But again, it was still a light, light tank, which, wasn't that, wasn't powerful enough, I guess. They actually ended up making Panzer threes and fours, but we're not going to go into all that. They mostly decided to use the Panzer twos for training exercises, in order to let the more advanced ones work a little better. So yeah, this is what we're going to be up against. You know, Miller and his men will have to deal with a whole bunch of Panzer tanks.
And even in a battle with light tanks, like tank versus people, it's not the most even of battles, we'll say.
Come on, it doesn't need to be even. That's what you want an underdog, don't you? How
I
can you
mean, it
have an
certainly makes for a
underdog?
great movie.
That's right. How can you have an underdog if the odds are not against you? That's what Miller screams out. Disperse. You know what to do. And then basically at this point there's complete chaos going around, but it's controlled chaos with the way that everyone's running and going and going to their posts, stuff like that. And you see, we see Ryben and Ryan look at each other, and Ryben looks at Ryan and is not happy. And Ryan like looks away a little bit as if he's somewhat ashamed, because Ryben realizes that okay, we're in for a lot right now. This is not going to be as simple of a cakewalk as we possibly thought it would be. So I like the way that they just give us that look. That's it. You don't have to go that far.
Yeah, I like that look too, where it's like it happens a couple times in the movie, but that particular look where he basically is silently saying like you better effing be worth it, you know.
Exactly.
Is
I think it's more
a
than that.
pretty
I think
great little bit of
it's I can't
wordless
believe that this is what you put us
acting.
in. I think it's more like I can't believe you put us in this situation. We better be able to get out of this. Myself especially, because we know how Robin is. He's thinking of himself mostly. So who knows? And at this point, the rest of the guys are getting ready, and Miller starts giving out orders to everybody, and he goes, "Ryben, get on the rabbit." "Yes, sir." "Up him, get some cover." And he goes, "Mellish, Henderson, lock and load." And then we get some random guy say, "This is it." And Miller goes, "Everybody check your ammo." And then Horvath is watching as Ryben gets on the rabbit to get out of there, and he goes, "Good luck, Ryben." He goes, "I don't need any luck, Sarge. I was born lucky." Now, in most movies, if a character says that, you pretty much think that that character is not going to survive.
That's true.
So it's very, very funny the way that he says that. And then Ryben and the driver just take off on the rabbit, and then we get a shot of Upham, who just is once again looking really, really confused as to what's going on. And then they give us another shot of the rabbit, where the it takes like a really, really sharp turn, and it looks like Ryben's about to fall out of it, as they're on their way to go check to see where the enemy is, that type of thing. It's just great. I love the way
Yeah,
they film that.
this whole sequence is pretty great.
Yeah.
And as they transition from, downtime to uptime, it's great to see them all spring into action and but have that sort of like trepidation still remain.
Exactly. We get another shot of Mellish and Henderson as they're getting ready, and the two of them start talking as they're getting it. And Henderson goes, "One in five, Tracer." "Yep." And the Tracer's pointed both ways. "Yeah, why don't you check the headspace?" And then he gets cut off as he's saying that. Now, do you know what a Tracer is?
Yeah, it's a, I don't know, it's basically a, for lack of a better way to say it, it's a bullet that like lights up so you can see where it's going. Kind of looks like a laser beam when you see them in real life. And yeah, it's a to assist in aiming. And the upside is you can see where your bullets are going a little clearer, and the downside is they do point directly back at you.
Exactly. So a tracer, or it's also known as tracer ammunition, they're bullets that are built with a small pyrotechnic charge in the base, so that when they're fired, the pyrotechnic composition is ignited by the burning power and burns very brightly, making the projectile trajectory visible to the naked eye during daylight and very bright during nighttime firing. This allows the shooter to visually trace the trajectory of the projectile and thus make necessary ballistic corrections without having to confirm projectile impacts without even using the sights of the weapon. Tracer fire can also be used as a marking tool to signal other shooters to concentrate their fire on a particular target during battle. When used, tracers are usually loaded as every fifth round in machine gun belt, referred to as a 4-to-1 tracer. So I've shot tracers, and they are really cool. And you know how you differentiate between a tracer and a regular bullet? You have any idea?
How's that?
They have a red dye on the tip of the bullet.
Oh, okay. So that makes sense. Some just visual indicator makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. Just it's just great to, you know, you're counting and you go 1, 2, 3, 4, tracer. 1, 2, 3, 4, tracer. And when you're using those type of, I mean, again, it makes a lot of sense. Tracer rounds were developed in 1915 by the British Army. In 1917, the U.S. started producing their own also. Before, they would use red colors, so the bullet tips on the tracers. So the tracers were identified by blackening the cartridge cases, so you would know that you know which ones they were. During World War II, Navy and Marine officers were issued tracer rounds with their sidearms, so that they could use them for emergency signaling if they ever needed stuff like that. So pretty interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense to you know shoot where I'm shooting, or to get someone's attention, or all kinds of
uses. I'm over here. Over here. yeah, unfortunately, tracers can also start fires. So you need to be careful where you're shooting them. they can cause grass fires and stuff like that if you shoot them in the wrong places and stuff like that.
Well, that makes sense because they are basically literally on fire, right?
Yes. Yes, yeah. More or less. Come on, baby, light my fire, right?
if anyone's unsure, I could say that, like, if you want to see how tracers really look, just watch that other World War II movie, Fury, in which every gun has at least one tracer every five bullets. And it looks really cool.
I can't understand why.
Looks like it looks like laser beams, and it's probably an unrealistic number of tracer bullets because there's so many. But it does look cool. It does aid in the visual aspect of the visual medium we call film.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. All right. That's all I have to say about this minute. Do you have anything else?
No. That's basically it. Okay. Same as last time. I just really enjoy the slow build toward the battle that's coming. I like that the sound design keeps slowly but surely building up the sound of the approaching tanks. You can start to hear voices in the distance. And I don't think it's this minute when stuff starts to actually rumble, but that's coming too. And this whole sequence is amazing. So I'm looking forward to continuing.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. All right, so every Wednesday we have a segment, which is probably another one that's going to be difficult for you to actually choose only five, called World War II Wednesday, where my guests will give their top five World War II movies. So once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
So this one is actually the easiest of the top fives I had to come up with for this week. But I'm going to preface my top five by saying that my actual favorite World War II thing is not a movie. It is a show. It is Band of Brothers by a country mile. And that is maybe, you know, cheating because that show has 10-hour-long episodes to get further into the characters and the story. But it is easily my favorite World War II thing.
Yeah, okay. I would agree with you on that.
But in terms of films, I would say that I'm going to start with my number five would probably be Oppenheimer, which is a fascinating portrait and look at the man who built the atomic bomb for America, and the one that Christopher Nolan finally won his best director Oscar for, and deservedly so, and the one that Cillian Murphy won best actor for, and deservedly so. And it's not exactly a wartime movie, but it is a World War II movie, and it's just a fascinating look at a particular man in a particular time, and at the military-industrial complex, and it is a legitimately great movie. Above that, I'm going to put Schindler's List, which I think is the other super important Steven Spielberg movie. Again, not exactly a, quote, war movie, but a very incredibly important and heartbreaking, touching World War II story about the Holocaust. Above that, I'm going to put last year's The Zone of Interest, which is a horrific, slow burn look at just how Nazis are. I find the movie very affecting. I find it such a masterwork in terms of like what it shows and what it doesn't, and just the casual cruelty and the mundanity of evil. It's a stunning portrait of a stunning time, and I feel like it should be required viewing in most schools. My number two is going to be this movie, Saving Private Ryan, which I believe to be one of the greatest war movies ever made. Everything about it, from the characters to the reenactment of the battle sequences to just the period accuracy. Like, there's only one major inaccuracy that I'm aware of in the battle sequences. And I think that they really strove to honor the time and the people involved in this war with this film, and I think they succeeded greatly. And then my favorite World War II movie is a classic. It is the Alec Guinness and William Holden starring Bridge on the River Kwai, which might be the quintessential dad movie, but it's also a wonderfully acted story about men in captivity during wartime. And if you haven't seen it, I don't want to spoil it for you,
I've
because you
seen
should definitely see it.
it.
But I think everyone, I'm not talking to you, Rob, I'm talking to everyone else. But it is a wonderful film with lots of themes of the things we do and the times we do them. I don't really want to say much else, but I'm a big William Holden fan as well, so that helps. Yeah, I love that movie a lot.
Well, it's very high on my list for a future season, so it hopefully will come about within the next few seasons.
Nice. I will say that this top five was actually probably the easiest of the four I came up with for this week of shows. And interestingly, I think the reason for that is actually that a lot of my favorite war movies are actually World War I movies. So that's just an interesting tidbit, I think.
Okay. For instance.
I mean, Lawrence of Arabia is World War I. All Quiet on the Western Front, both versions of that are World War I, for example.
Okay. Makes sense. All right, that's great. Thank you very much for that. Would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Absolutely. The easiest way to find me is my personal website, which is stretched.ca. Being a freelance film critic, I write a lot of things for a lot of places, and I link to all of them from there. You can also find links to my socials and Patreon if you're into that kind of thing. You can find me in most places at Matthew AF, and I'm most active on Blue Sky and on Threads.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. If you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook. And you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earnest. My solitude, you